Now we've got Adrian from Two Valleys Radio. He hasn't done anything yet.
We've been working all day. Thank you, and thank you very much to the people who spoke to Paddy, to Ruby, to Hayley, and to Eugene today. Two Valleys Radio is a brand new community radio project covering the Combe Valley and the Home Valley. And I'm sure it's hot and sunny in the Home Valley at the moment, even though it's cold here. And twovalleysradio.co.uk. We're starting off reflecting culture in the Two Valleys and also looking at how to make places a better thing. So we wanted to come along today, invited today, thank you very much, to try and get some of the messages from what you've been talking about to other people. And Paddy will be working over the weekend editing something for the website. And hopefully when we broadcast out of Honley in December, we'll be doing more of a programme, feature programme, about all the issues. But we also said it would be quite interesting to try and put something together from the day for you to look at and listen to before the plenary session. So some of the thoughts, very quickly edited, for you to think about 5 minutes long.
Why are you here today, except for buttering your scones?
Apart from buttering the scones, and I'm up to about 50 or 60 now, so that's good. I'm here to learn more. I'm really interested to see how my community down in South Leeds could learn from the Transition Towns Initiative and, yeah, hopefully start to get ready for some really major changes and embrace those changes and grow and become better as a community.
And we're looking at what's going to happen when the oil runs out, peak oil, and we're looking at climate change as well and what we can do in the local community to kind of stop climate change or reduce its impact.
I guess it's that idea of moving towards a much more sustainable goal, really trying to think more inwards and locally.
Looking at food, we're looking at energy, we're looking at climate change, there's all sorts of different things, so people will come with certain ideas and hopefully take away lots of different ones.
The most important message today, it is we the people, cooperatively together, can do something about climate change and not say, why isn't the government doing something?
I've always had a deep interest in the environment, and I can see why we need to change, because if we don't, then younger generations are going to suffer from our lack of action. People, I think, can be insular, and they can be, to put it bluntly, they can be lazy. The problem is our present lifestyle isn't sustainable. And really, that's what this is about. It's about engaging with the process of change, which we all need to be part of.
We're a group of 15 young people from the West Yorkshire area who are setting up a fair trade business into fair trade products.
And what do you think is the most important message about today?
To plan ahead for more challenging times.
Working together, I think. Just getting to know each other and working together. Just come along to one of our meetings and see what you're interested in, and we'll help you develop any projects or events that you want to do.
We go home and we change our light bulbs and we turn the thermostat down a little bit. And actually there's a certain amount that you can do just on your own, but if you go up a scale and you look at this in terms of your community, your street, people around you, and you design a process which feels fun and historic and is really engaging for people, we can do a whole lot more. We become much, much more than the sum of our parts. And so the thing from today is that's what the cooperative movement did in the 1800s, and it's how communities like this flourished. And we need to do the same thing again, although we're moved by different challenges.
That was really inspiring, that the same ideas and the same vision for a better world were being thought about way back then.
What I've learned this morning, it's not so much learning things like facts, it's making connections with real people who can kind of share, you know, what their experiences are and their perspectives, and just getting an insight into a much bigger picture.
I've probably learned primarily that there is hope, and that is really going to come through inclusiveness, through networking, and through actually coming to terms with the fact that we have to change, we have to be prepared to make that change.
I think it's about how we manage that growth of the idea, how you spread the idea around people and keep them enthusiastic, but without going off at half cock or duplicating work that other people are doing.
It's very encouraging to hear what people can do locally, and it's been especially good to see what people have achieved from the bottom up with initiatives that haven't been led by the government but by people with the talents and skills to make their communities better, coming together and having good fun in the process.
Started the day being here to learn, and I'm still learning, but the difference is that now I can see a clearer way forward to finding out more, and I'm quite empowered by that.
Things like this are always very stimulating. I mean, when you go and do something new, you never really know what's going to happen, do you?
Right, okay. And the camera's been found, by the way, so everyone... Right. Okay, now you all know from this morning just how wonderful my time calculation is. I make it nearly 20 past four. We've got till five. I'm going to be summing up at the end. So I think we've got about half an hour now for a plenary session. That's to give us a chance to think about almost anything from today, but maybe as we get through the plenary, we've got slightly different speakers up or respondents up on the stage, but maybe as we get through the plenary as well, we could be starting to think about what can we build on from today in the next steps, things that maybe can grow out of this. In terms of the people up on the board, up on the platform, we've got Bob Bilton, who's chair of the board of the Co-op Bank. So I don't know what that means, what questions you might have arising from that. And we've got Helen Seymour, and I can't remember your role in Cooperatives UK, Helen.
I'm head of projects and development, and I'm also trustee of the Plunkett Foundation, so right. Two hats on.
Okay, so maybe we'll just start by going back to the same format we had before. If people have questions or thoughts or comments, if you could put your hand up and we'll try and pull things together from there. Gentleman with his hand up already, if we've got a roving mic.
Yeah, Richard Dillon from Transition Keithley and the Keithley Co-op Group. It was around the issues of localisation, but also about justice. And as I suppose it's an anxiety that there's an assumption that just because something's local, that somehow it's virtuous, it's going to create well-being. And it's a worry that we'll go down this path and in some ways not learn the lessons of the co-op movement, in which local mill workers were confronted by local mill owners who compelled them to buy high-priced adulterated food. And it was that suffering that actually created the birth of the co-op movement. And it's about, if we're thinking about localising food, how can we build in that sense of justice into it?
Thank you. A couple of other questions, maybe? Has everyone questioned out? We've got right at the front here and one in the middle there at the back. Yeah.
It's referring to really a question that was asked earlier before lunch.
And you are, sorry?
Sorry, Ruth Haywarden from the Newcastle Transition Group in Durham. The lady brought up the thing about parochialism, and Rob answered it around the issue of food. But I felt it was a wider question in terms of transition town and looking outwards, the flow of ideas, social justice, all these things that are good about today. And really sort of the wider picture of where does transition town sort of stand in that, as it were.
Okay. And
you asked us where to go next, John D. Anderson from Bradford.
Might need to hold the mic up a bit more. Maybe it's not on.
Do you want to?
It says on.
Okay. Try again.
Yeah.
John D. Anderson, Transition, Bradford. You asked where we go next. I would like to suggest that the cooperative movement sets up a green fund for financing cooperative energy generation. It has been mentioned several times. I believe that if we're going to reduce CO2 emissions, the most massive way to do this is to get rid of fossil fuel power stations within the next 20 years. And to do that, we have to generate electricity renewably, and we need capital, masses of capital, to have cooperative, local distributed energy generation.
Great. Three great questions. So, Bob, would you like to kick off?
I'll start actually with the last one, if I may. In the session that I was in just before this plenary session, I think we did start to talk about the opportunity for cooperatives in energy and the importance of new forms of energy, because I mean climate change is fundamentally an energy problem. And so I certainly agree with the thrust of John's question. In terms of the worldwide scale, I guess it's not huge. What I can tell you is that actually the Cooperative Bank has set aside a dedicated fund. I think it's something like £400 million to fund renewables projects. And it has taken a proactive stance so far in helping a number of existing renewables projects. We have quite a challenge on our hands in terms of interesting other types of cooperative to think more energetically and to think more positively about this, but it's a challenge that, you know, I think we have to work on and deliver on. And again, to refer back to the session that we just had, John, where I was saying that one of the best things that I've seen happen in the last month as a result of the international project was different types of cooperatives come together. One of those, interestingly, is an energy cooperative that's developed in Belgium called Eco Power. I don't know if any of you have ever come across it, but I think it's, you know, a very fine example, and I'm quite sure that more will follow. The climate project I talked about will inevitably walk hand in hand with an energy working group which is being established on a European wide basis, and I think that will go worldwide too. I think what I'm saying is, yes, I think you're right.
So, Bob, will the details of that £400 million fund be able to be put onto the Transition North website so people can follow up and find out more?
Yeah, I think so. What we can.
Do you want to pick up on any of the other two questions?
No, I think...
He'll hand those over gracefully.
Rob's... Come on, Rob. Earn your call.
I think in terms of the social justice question, transition is something which is less than 4 years old and has grown incredibly fast. And I think we've always taken a position about... It's about what's implicit and what's explicit. And that actually there's lots about transition which is implicit. I've not come across any initiatives that have come through transition which take a sort of a damaging approach that dismiss the idea of social justice. It's something which is implicit within the model and in how people interpret it. But you know, it's this is an approach which is, by its very nature, is iterative and it's evolving and it's learning. And you know, if it turns out that actually people feel that it's something that really needs to be really upfront and very, very explicit. But so far, my sense has been that actually it's something that has been inherently core within the model and central to what people do. And of course, there's a danger that relocalization on its own isn't some sort of fantastic God-given thing that's going to sort everything out. It has to be accompanied by ethics and principles, and obviously there are plenty of examples, many, many examples one could list of where localization has been really quite deeply unpleasant. So I think underpinning it with those values is really important, but whether they're implicit or whether they're made explicit is another thing. I think that in relation to the parochialism question, I think it's really important to make a distinction between economic globalization and cultural globalization. and the process of cultural globalization and people being more connected and familiar with the world and all of the exchange of ideas and cultures and values and so on has been really useful and is essential. Economic globalization, i.e. the idea that we can that it's cheaper to bring apples here from New Zealand than it is to bring apples from up the road, is something which is only made possible by huge amounts of cheap fossil fuel enabling that process to happen. And that's what we need to be really looking to build resilience to. And so it's not about the process of individual communities relocalizing isn't a process of them putting up some big sort of fence around themselves and sort of, you know, and kind of going back in time and taking a vote away from women and, you know, ghastly, horrible, nasty kind of, you know, but it's really, the way I like to think about it is I remember when I was 16, no, when I was 18 and I finished doing my exams at school and I was sitting on the step of school with all these people who I'd been with for the last 4 or 5 years in school, thinking, what a hopeless lot. What a useless lot. None of us could do anything. You know, we had our bits of paper, but none of us could build anything or grow anything or sew anything. And you know, if you'd washed us all up on a desert island, we wouldn't even know how to eat each other. And actually, I think when two people meet each other from a position of being mutually...
Meet or eat?
Meet. When two people meet each other from a position of being mutually useless, it's a very different relationship than when two people who are skilled and who think, when they meet, can think their way around a challenge. Yeah? And I think we've lost a huge amount of that. And I think as communities, when we meet each other as communities who know that we have within the ability to weather shock, the ability to turn our hand to anything, we know the terrain around, we've got those, we've rebuilt those, that web of networks that cheap oil has really gone through with a pair of scissors, then we're much, much more resilient. And I don't think that leads to parochialism. I think that leads to people with a stronger sense of place, more skilled, more connected with each other, who then, their outlook on the world and how they then meet each other, the relationship with which they then meet other communities is a much richer and a much stronger relationship than it is at the moment, where it's all based on sort of mutual dependency.
I think he feels strongly about that. Helen.
Just two very quick and I hope connected points. And it's about the issue of justice, which is a crucial one. And it's what I'd like to talk about is this sort of collective approach. Collective approaches is what we're talking about in all sorts of different fields, but also about fairness. And it's about collective approaches to fairness. And so with food systems, for example, it can be making sure through a farmer's market, through a buying group, through a CSA or whatever, that you're actually giving a fair price to that farmer. We know that farming has been in a very difficult position and farmers are not well paid by and large, particularly in this area and in hill farmers, for their goods and for their produce. So about collective approaches that ensure that the producer gets a fair deal, and that also can be transferred to overseas markets as well. And, you know, fair trade does that on a big scale, but also empowering people at, you know, at the sharp end to have responses to that. The other thing on the green energy, I think we have to take some responsibility ourselves for putting our own resources in, our own money in, and all the rest of it. I know we can all just sign up to a green energy scheme at home and feel smug about it, but how about, for example, putting our money into some of Energy for All's wind power projects? There's going to be a big one here shortly. You know, find that £100 or whatever it might be to make sure things happen, you know, in a way that you can then be a member of something and influence it. It's about self-help, ultimately.
Great. Just picking up, abusing my chair's privilege, picking up on that last point, something that often strikes me when I'm listening to people talk about money is I'm thinking about how much we tend to have invested through our pensions in stock markets. Now, that's a really interesting place to put money, isn't it? And that's a really thinking about flows and grids, the money grid, and what that, the impact that has on the world. And could we take more power ourselves? It's possible now under legislation with a lot of pensions to take your pension out of stock markets and put it in a SIP, a self-invested personal pension. and use that SIP in almost any way you want. Put it into Energy for All, put it into other things, put it into local schemes. And might that make us feel more connected to our own future, possibly? Anyway, shouldn't abuse my chair's prerogative. So more questions, please, or thoughts. Gentleman at the back there with a beard. And there's a lady right here at the very front.
Gareth Roberts, Transition Sheffield. We're looking forward to setting up a successful CSA project in Sheffield, but it's given rise to a number of questions, one of which I know is shared by a number of people here today. And what I found very interesting this morning was Peter's presentation towards the end about how he posed the question around what links all the elements of a local food system, you know, what sits in the middle of that system. And it's just a way forward, a suggestion for a way forward. You know, can we have that addressed by the Plunkett Foundation, by the Making Local Food Works programme? You know, because we're all trying to answer that question. You know, what sits at the middle of a local food system in terms of legal, governance, ownership, finance, all of those things that we're all doing separately for individual projects. How can we set something up that does what it needs to do at that sort of level of coordination or whatever? So.
Thank you.
Oh, it's Bridget Lechner from Stockport. A couple of times today, the thought has cropped up. What does the model say about politics? Because sooner or later, every initiative is going to come up against power structures, whole systems of power who give you the big no-no. How do you work through the political process?
Great question. Any other questions? Maybe one more?
Someone right at the back? Oh, we'll do four then. Okay. This lady here and then the gentleman at the back.
I'm Elizabeth James from Transition Town, Durham, and I've also been a member of the cooperative for a while now. I've heard that the cooperative is planning to set up one of its first eco stores from its food business. And I know that also the cooperative food business are in the process of taking over Summerfield. So given that that's happening, you'll have a large property bank. I wondered if there were wider plans on a national level, perhaps, to turn your stores, or your banks as well, or your pharmacies, into eco-pharmacies, banks and stores and so on.
Thank you. And right at the back.
Yeah, thanks. My name's Andy Speechley. I wondered about a more direct way forward in relation to where we are right now, and about proposing something like a kind of a think tank, as it were, to maintain the momentum of this extraordinary, wonderful day. And I don't know how the rest of the people feel other than the people on stage.
Great. Right. Take your pick. Someone start off. Helen, you went last time.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's one of the things that is part of that sort of political process, but also is absolutely key for, I think what you're talking about, Gareth, is sort of resilient food systems. How can we have, you know, and everything, you know, that bananas still come on a boat from West Africa or the Caribbean, but also we have much more control about the meat we eat and the vegetables we eat and so forth. One of the crucial things within the UK is access to land. That is absolutely fundamental, whether it's for allotments, for CSAs, for small-scale farming. And, you know, we know that Tesco's is sitting on huge land banks. We know that, you know, Duke of Westminster owns half of the area north of here, Forest of Bowland, and other huge areas. The cooperative also has land. Maybe it can look at little slices here and there that it could turn over for community use. That will be a hugely positive, not just gesture, a real make a difference in lots of communities. But the access to land and access to the loosening in a positive way some of the planning restrictions around land and leasing and so forth would be very important. And I would like to put a challenge out that we all try and work together, if only on that one aspect.
Okay. Helen, could you...
Helen, could you put that challenge onto the forum? The website's got a forum from today, and if people put things coming out from today onto that forum, then there's a place where other people can comment and communicate and things can build from that. And I would also just quickly say the proceedings from today have all been recorded, and so the presentations from this morning and the sound files from this morning will be available on the forum. If anyone feels strongly that they desperately want to transcribe those wonderful speeches this morning, do step forward and volunteer. Rest of you.
If I could perhaps respond to, I think it was the penultimate question or comment. To the best of my knowledge, the cooperative group does not at present envisage converting its estate to a whole series of eco-stores. What it is doing, which I think is quite a challenge, it has set itself the objective of reducing its energy consumption by 25% in 5 years by 2012, and I think is well on the way to achieving that. To be perfectly honest with you, I don't know. I'm not personally au fait with the detail of the EcoStore project that you referred to. I suspect that the group's ambitions will not totally satisfy this audience, but despite, I think it is actually a very significant contribution which is being made.
Thank you. Rob, I think you've got left what sits in the middle of local food, and I might have a comment on that too, and politics. Let's start with the easy one.
Transition has always taken a position of being avowedly a-party political and not building any alliances in that regard. And I think that's been very beneficial. And I think we've always tried to have it so that it's as accessible to people from a range of things, from a range of views. One of the things that's been most interesting in Totnes that's happened is that with the Energy Descent Plan that we've been working on, which will be published soon, it looks like all of the main party candidates running in the next election are going to be running with a copy of that as part of their platform, which feels really interesting, you know, that we've got to that stage. What else to say about that? I don't know, really.
Do you want to mention the hustings idea?
I think there's been some people... Oh, yeah, that's one of the things. Yeah, we often get asked, you know, what's Transition Network going to do in the run-up to the next election? And we've been talking about doing something about resilience and some kind of a resilience manifesto that can be dropped in anywhere, which is really about why resilience thinking needs to be at the centre of all policy-making and decision-making in that regard. I know a lot of transition groups get involved with their local authority and their local council, and in some places even run as independents around a kind of transition issue. And Alexis Rowell, who some of you may know, who's who's a councillor in Camden in London, he's writing a book as part of the Transition Books series, which is all about getting involved with your local council and actually getting involved and getting on and trying to change things from the inside in that regard. So. And I know with Transition Stroud, for example, they were working with the local council up to the stage where the local council's the deputy head said something like, if Transition Stroud didn't exist, we'd have to make them up. And I think that way of really getting in and being very useful, and a lot of what transition groups do is they're able to do thinking and ask questions that councils often still really feel they can't ask. And so the fresh thinking and the innovative way of looking at it that comes through transition is something a lot of local authorities find quite useful, I think. In terms of food, we were talking about this earlier on. I think what we're seeing at the moment is a flowering of all kinds of local food projects, as was in the talk earlier on today. And how they all hang together is, I think, really the big question of the next few years. And there's lots of people asking that question. And so with Transition Network, we're looking at doing this Can Britain Feed Itself project, which scales up what we were doing for the Totnes and District one, and really looks at what that might look like and how that system works. Because I think often, I'd always thought in my work teaching permaculture and in local food that actually it's about vegetables and it's about fruit. But actually, one of the things that came out of the Totnes study was that's the easy bit. Actually, the vegetables is easy. You know, it's the cereals and the carbohydrates and how all of that stuff hangs together needs bigger kind of scale strategic thinking and doesn't necessarily go with that very local kind of approach. It's a further afield sort of thing. So I think it needs to be looked at really systematically, and it needs lots of organisations to come together. But that thinking really, really needs to be done, because as I said before, it's not just going to happen by accident. And I think one of the tools that the energy descent planning process that we've been trialing in Totnes and a few other places are starting now is really useful in terms of starting to pull those elements together, like local economy and energy and housing and food, and looking at the settlement in a strategic kind of a way. But how it happens nationally, I think, is something that's still emergent.
And just building on that, from a food perspective, a strategy was written for Bristol on how you would do exactly that, join together all those bits and coordinate them. And in fact, a whole bid was put together. The bid wasn't successful, but that strategy's there of how do you take a city and try to design a coherent joining up and process which looks at all of the parts of the food supply chains, everything. And I know that's now being picked up in Scotland in a couple of cities where they're looking for funding to see if they can do that. So there are some ideas emerging. On the politics front, in the lead up to an election, something that Rob and I have been talking about and that we feel is really interesting is if Transition Network were to produce a one or two-sider on what does resilience mean, because resilience isn't just a transition concept. You know, there's some very, very interesting different interpretations of resilience coming out of central government and other entities. But if we did that, you know, a local transition initiative could say to all the local political candidates, come along to a hustings and we want to ask you all the same questions and we want to listen to your answers. And, you know, all politicians are very interested in active members of their constituencies. So that could be quite powerful, I think. John, I know you had a specific idea, maybe one or two others, and then we'll move towards the summing up. One or two other people with points? Gentleman right over in the corner. And can't see, there's a hand up in the middle there too. Yeah.
Paul Hansen from Hull Transition. I've just been to an excellent workshop about Todd Morden and inedible edibles. Is it? Edible, inedible. Incredible inedibles, that's the one. he was speaking about the fact that they're achieving all sorts of wonderful things there without actually even mentioning peak oil and climate change, and implying that in fact can be counterproductive in that it causes all sorts of divisions and their policies to be much more inclusive and keep things as simple as possible, focus on food, which is something that we all need, so it includes everyone. I just wondered what Rob thought about that strategy, because for Hull, I'm thinking that possibly might be a way forward for us in terms of not alienating a large section of the population by concentrating on peak oil and climate change.
Thank you. Lady in the middle.
Hello, my name's Kath. I'm from Footprint Workers Co-op and Cornerstone Housing Co-op in Chapeltown in Leeds. I wondered, well, actually, I don't suppose any of you can necessarily answer the question, but I just kind of thought it would be interesting to know whether the co-op group and other of the kind of large co-op entities had any thoughts about encouraging people to buy less, how, you know, whether that was part of their future strategy.
And John.
Yeah, this was about where we go forward with this. And I was having a discussion with Christine Take on just before she left. And it seems that the cooperative group has huge resources, and if you could identify an area of land and design a project where you could say, well, okay, in this area we're growing huge amounts of stuff and there are lots and lots of stores that are very close by, and designing a pilot project which could be done with both the transition movement and with the co-op to say, well, okay, how are we going to get that stuff directly from the fields into the shops? And I think it's probably it's quite a monumental task to get that thing going, but if we could start a debate and some sort of pressure group to do that, it shouldn't cost the co-op group too much money to do it. And I'd imagine if the results they get are anything like the results we get in the Green Valley Grocer, it'll be wildly successful, because the things we sell out of straight away are the stuff that's grown just down the road. So it seemed like a nice, one of the things that we could possibly aim at coming out of this conference.
Thank you. Okay. Panel responses. I'm not sure whether that's a question or just a this is what we're going to do. So let's be positive. That's what's going to happen. That's what we're going to do. Buying less, using peak oil and climate change or not. Buying less has to be you, Bob.
I think I can tell you with absolutely clearly that, yes, the cooperative group would like you to buy less from Tesco. I think the leap to saying that the cooperative group would like to persuade you to buy less is not quite there at the moment. So, but I understand where you're coming from. In relation to the other point, I don't know actually. Our friend from Hull, was it? Yeah. I was talking earlier in my workshop about climate change. I have to say, I tend to think that I don't think we can pretend that it's not happening, and and fail to try to persuade people of the importance of it. So, just very personally, I think my instinct would be, and I say I have to qualify this heavily, which is from my perspective in, you know, what I'm trying to do and what the cooperatives that I work with are trying to do. I don't think that I would advocate that approach. But it might be interesting, because my colleagues here may well say something quite different.
Colleagues?
Oh, I don't have to go last for once.
That's what they say in supermarkets, isn't it?
I think the work that incredible Edible Todmorden are doing has been absolutely fantastic. And I'm a huge admirer of that approach and that model. But it is distinctly different, I think, from transition. I mean, there is a huge range of organisations out there doing all kinds of stuff. You know, Paul Hawken in Blessed Unrest talks about it as being, you know, these millions and millions of people and organisations around the world, from individual people planting trees to big organisations, as being like the planet's immune system kicking in at this time in history. And there are all kinds of different manifestations of that. And the incredible edible model is a fantastic way of getting food in, getting edible landscapes back around people, taking away that idea that, oh, well, you can't do that because you're not allowed. You know, well, you just go out in the night and you plant them, and you know, and that guerrilla gardening approach is absolutely fantastic. But it is distinctly different, I think, because what transition initiatives are doing is ultimately building up to a community design process, in effect, for how this community is going to increase its resilience and get through the next 15 or 20 years in a better shape than where it starts from now. And one of the things, when Peter was talking about resilience before, in some of the government, the way that the government has been looking at this question of resilience, and Demos and people have been looking at it, is there's a really big question about resilient to what? Because actually, if you set out to make this country resilient to terrorist attacks and pandemics, then the solutions that you come up with are very, very different than when you're looking at peak oil and climate change. So I think that it's a really skillful, I think, to identify peak oil and climate change as the lens that you look at this through. And you know, there are some people for whom, I mean, my experience is that actually, if all transition was about trying to convince people that peak oil was a reality,
it wouldn't have got as far as it has, or if it was around climate change. You know, the way the transition model is designed is it has lots and lots of edge and lots of surface area. So if you're not interested in those things, but you like local carrots, there's a food aspect of it you can get involved in. If you're an artist and you like doing creative community processes, you get involved in the art side of it. If you're into music and theatre, there's ways in as well. So it's designed so that people can come into it from all different ways, and that stuff is sometimes made explicit and sometimes it's not made explicit. It's about putting the hats on and off of what's most appropriate at different times. But at its core, I think having peak oil and climate change as the lenses through which we try and observe the degree to which the process is increasing the resilience of the community in question, they're really essential. And that's what makes it a distinctly different approach, I think.
Thank you, Rob. Helen, final comment?
Two quick comments. One is that, you know, I suppose it's a really sort of slightly hippie 60s thing to say, but it is about let a thousand flowers bloom and lots of different responses according to your local circumstances, your own energies, the how much money you have, you know, who you're working with, etc. And all those things are relatively easy. I mean, they're hard, but fun and, you know, but relatively easy. But there's also, we have to recognise there are hugely complicated issues around feeding a country of 60 million people. And we can't shy away from that. So I'd like to sort of segue on gently to the point that somebody made about a think tank. And I think that we are really at the foothills of this debate, and there are all sorts of really good people that have done lots of thinking for us in advance. People like Professor Tim Lang at City University, organisations like Sustain, the Soil Association. There is a wealth, you know, Plunkett has got a great website and lots of different local food solutions. Let's actually work together better. I don't know, we can start by working together locally or in our own cities or whatever in bringing people together to share information. And I think information and good practice is key to all of this.
Thank you. So John asked me to sum up, which I'm going to do, and I've very competently left myself oodles of time in which to do that. So I'm going to start by just doing a couple of housekeeping type things, which is that I know that some people have come here from transition not knowing necessarily that much about the cooperative and not knowing necessarily that it was a member-led organisation and just how much power members have to change this large organisation's direction and influence it. So if you are interested in becoming a member, your first port of call, apparently, is the membership office for your local region. There are 9 regions, and they're all on the cooperative website. I'd also like to thank you for being a lovely audience, in case I forget to do that at the end, and a really interesting audience. Great questions. So in my summing up, I'm going to make it personal, because I can't possibly sum up all of this stuff that's gone on. I'm just going to talk about how I feel about today. And one or two things where I feel differently, I think, than things that have been said. So Bob said that climate change is fundamentally an energy problem. And I really disagree. I really, really strongly disagree. And this maybe comes back to a part of transition which doesn't get talked about all that often, which is the heart and soul part of transition, which is the part about looking inwards to ourselves, about who we are, what we believe, what motivates us, because I don't see how we can change what we do in the world unless we start to change how we are inside. That's certainly the case for me. And so I don't think my own climate change activities in terms of the carbon that I generate are just about energy at all. I think they're about what I think about myself, what I think will make me happy, what I think I have to do, what I think I need to do. And all of those come back to that heart and soul point about my beliefs, my values. One of my favourite authors, Edward Said, said that we cannot engage in meaningful political activity without optimism. And I fundamentally agree, but I also turn that on its head. I don't think that we can have optimism unless we engage in meaningful activity of some sort or another. And what makes activity meaningful? Well, again, I'm going to just talk for myself. For
For me, what makes activity meaningful is doing it with other people. It's not doing it on my own. And that's what is so central and core to both any cooperative movement and transition. It's the idea that as individual, alienated, isolated beings, we are perfect targets for a message that says buy more, consume more. Somehow satiate that inner feeling of emptiness or loneliness or fear by acquiring things, by having things. And for me, what both the cooperative movement and transition are about saying actually happiness, meaning, comes from something very different, from being rather than having. And I can only move in that direction with other people around me. And I can very honestly say that over the last few years, as I've got more involved in transition and other similar sorts of things, I am way, way, way happier. Just incomparably happier. And, you know, I come out of a day like today and I'm empowered. And I'm empowered because I'm being with all of you. And that's what it's about. You know, if we leave this to governments, as Rob says, if we leave this to governments, well, we can see what governments are doing. We can see what's going on in the world. It's bloody hopeless, isn't it? But if we remember that governments are made up of people like us, and we band together, and we show that change is possible, and we do different things, and we change ourselves, and we invite them to do that with us, then maybe we'll hit that Goldilocks moment where it's just bad enough to wake enough people up to make changes and change things and go out there, and it's still maybe there's time to do something meaningful. You know, and actually, even if there isn't time, we might as well try, mightn't we? So for me, there's an enormous story underpinning this. There's a cultural story about what do we think of ourselves, what makes us meaningful, and this exploration today with a focus particularly, I think, on justice, and therefore a focus on ownership, and that's not just ownership of land, that's ownership, real meaningful ownership of the enterprises we collaborate in, cooperatively or however. That's the beginning of a movement towards meaning and sustainability and resilience. So thank you very much, everyone. Thank you.